I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Joaquin Jorjal, who's a biogeographer and community ecologist working at the Natural History Museum of the Spanish Scientific Council in Madrid. He also collaborates with the Center for Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Changes of the University of Lisbon and the Department of Ecology and the Federal University of Goiás in Brazil. And before, he worked at the University of the Azores, University of Copenhagen, and Imperial College London. He studies the effects of current and past environmental conditions and ecological processes on the geographic patterns of biodiversity, the role of species niche and ecological interactions in the organization of biological communities in time and space, and the use and misuse of biodiversity in big data. He worked with mosses, seed plants, vertebrates, and insects. And before this, we had a really interesting interview about the ecology and biogeography of dung beetles. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
Thanks a lot. And hi, Derek. Thanks for the interest in our work.
So that paragraph that I read about your interests is kind of a mouthful, but I think if we slow it down, it is extremely interesting and important stuff. Mm-hmm. So can we start with the word biogeography and just ask what that is and why is that important?
Yeah, well, biogeography is the science that studies how is life on Earth, the distribution of life on Earth, both in space throughout the Earth and through time, how it changes through time and how it changes through space. And it's a synthesis science. It has a lot of ecology and evolution embedded on it. And actually, it has like more than 150 years since Wallace did this amazing work compiling the variations in the distribution and the different what at the time they called zoogeographical regions, okay, and trying to understand why some things look similar in space, some species look similar in space, and why different regions have different faunas and floras, okay, and it is quite important not only to understand what's the origin of life on Earth and what's the origin of biodiversity on Earth and why it diversifies, because a part of it, actually, I don't know if you are aware of that, but the current theory of evolution was proposed by both Darwin and Wallace. At the same time, they were thinking about things together, but instead of emailing, etc., they were sending letters to one each other, and they were reading other people. Actually, the evolutionary ideas were already in the community at the time, but they reached to similar conclusions in parallel. I mean, Darwin did before, but he started to work on that. And Wallace, when he was exploring, he explored the Amazon and then he explored the Malay archipelago. He came with the ideas just by working there in the field. And actually, the first formulation of this theory of evolution before the seminal papers that were presented together in the Royal Society on behalf of Darwin and Wallace, the first mention is how transmutation, which is the origin for the word evolution, is the way they talk about evolution before, biological evolution. This transmutation was linked by Wallace to spatial distance. He did mention that new species arose nearby similar species, okay? So it's already a significant part of evolution, okay? Because things do happen in the space, okay? So it's important for theoretical things, but it also provides the basis for many of the works that we are doing right now to understand the effects of global change and to make predictions about how global change, both climate change, land use changes, pollution, etc. We are using a lot of biogeographical knowledge and techniques to forecast what may happen in future scenarios. Many of the tools that we see about how biodiversity may decline or which could be the impact if we put a dam here or do or do this kind of action or do this kind of transformation with this fragment of forest, etc., do come from biogeography.
So can you give some tangible examples of what you're talking about? Because I'm still a little bit hazy.
Yes. So, for example, I don't know if you have heard that we believe that with climate change, many species are going to have to migrate. Okay? So we don't know to what extent that is true for many species, okay? Because, but the tools we use to understand the areas that will be adequate in the future are tools from biogeography. What we do is we model the relationship of the species with climate. We get as much information as possible, and if we have some information from experiments or from some physiological measurements, that's even better. But what we do is to model that distribution according to climate for the species, and then we project it to the future scenarios that we've got. We've got models for how the future may be, okay? And we have many different models, but we can make many different projections and assess the probability with some degree of uncertainty, of course, of each area of the map to be suitable for the species in the future. In a practical thing, for example, that is being applied for in vineyards, okay? People working with wine in many areas of the earth, in Spain for sure, but in other regions, they are looking for the grape varieties that are more suited not to the climate we've got now, but for the climate we know we are going to have in the future. Okay, and this is a tool. This response curves to climate are made using biographical tools and biographical theory. Okay. The other part of the biogeography is one is how they respond to climate, and then the other part is how a species may be able to move. If we identify that a species is not going to be able to track climate or adapt locally, which is more difficult. So if we identify this species is not going to be able to adapt locally and it's going to have to track climate, okay, then we can translocate the species and put some populations in future areas to make sure that the species survives. That could be an example.
So I'm sorry to be dense, but can we go to get really basic on what this would mean in a reasonably healthy, I want to understand the principles behind it.
Yeah.
So I mean, all I know is that if you, well, first off is, I mean, if you have I'm just thinking that like I live near the ocean, and there are coastal redwoods here, but then there are mountains to the east, and you go 5 miles and there's no longer coastal fog, which means it's no longer coastal redwood, but instead it's ponderosa pine and white oak and Doug fir.
Yeah.
And is that part of what we're talking about, is those transitions?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when we talk about climate, we can think about at large scales about average temperature or mean annual precipitation, but the truth is that the species and the communities are usually linked to particular conditions in the soil, to the conditions which are particularly difficult to model, the conditions of the fogs that come from the ocean, how the ocean influences this, which are the main wind currents, etc. So yeah, it is related to that. The thing is that there are different levels of complexity. And at the level that you're talking about, there are different components about that microclimate, okay? Microclimatic components, and probably there are also edaphic components, that's soil conditions that relate to which species are thriving in its place. But it also depends. So a way of putting it in a very basic way, in a very simple way, is that we know that a species can live in a place where it can have populations that survive, have a positive growth, okay? That's conditions. It has been able to arrive or to evolve there. So you need individuals to reach the place to be colonized, okay? And it hasn't got extinct because of anything. This may seem quite basic, but these are the three things that we try to model. The conditions that determine which would be the growth of the populations, whether it's a positive growth or a negative growth, the populations will be decreasing. Okay, those are the conditions, and then it's arriving to the place, colonizing it, and then taking into account mortality, which may be related to the conditions or may be related with a fire, for example, or a catastrophic event, or a disease that comes and ends up with that population. Okay, the outcome of those three kinds of processes is what we study, actually, in biogeography. We try to put all these things together. And that has a high level of complexity, of course, because the local conditions are not only this microclimate, are those small microtopographic features that determine that you got this component of the winds that takes humidity from the coast. If you get too near to the coast, you got salt spill. So you need species to evolve the resistance to salt, okay? Or you need a species that are able to resist salt to arrive there to colonize, and so forth and so on.
So how? How does one? I'm thinking of the line that I first heard by David Ehrenfeld, but I know somebody else said it first, which is, nature's not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking. And that, I'm not suggesting that we just throw up our hands and say, yeah. No idea, but I'm thinking about, as you're doing this modeling, you must run into, well, I'll just give an example that back in the 90s, Chris Mazur wrote this article about how when they tried to replant Doug fir plantations, they were quite often failing. And one reason they were failing, it ends up, is because in order to thrive, Doug firs need a certain type of mycorrhiza on their root tips. And they get that by red-backed voles eating the fungus and pooping it on the soil, and then the root tips find the poop and develop the relationship. But without red-backed voles, you don't have any Doug firs.
Yeah.
And that's a simple one. So it's like, how do you, I mean, and that's one of the reasons I love thinking and talking about nature, is just I marvel at all of those relationships. Yeah. So how does all of that fit into your modeling?
Yeah, so the thing is that we've got this old sentence that I'm Levin used to use. I don't know if it's from him, probably it's not, it's older, that all models are wrong, but some of them are more useful than others. Well, that's the thing. I mean, a model is always a simplification. It's something that we use for a purpose, okay? The purpose of understanding, and perhaps the purpose of making forecasts of whatever. We have to simplify things for sure, because, I mean, accounting for all those small complexities, actually, you're talking about a kind of interaction between three species altogether, three or four at the same time, which is complex already. But imagine that those interactions are variable between different individuals of the same species. Within all this. So, I mean, we also have models to account for individual variation. But putting all of them together, it's really, really, really complex. So we have to try to simplify. And I'm going to put you on an example. Jorge Soberón, who is in the University of Kansas, is originally from Mexico. And John Peterson, they did a very simple, what they call the BAM diagram. BAM is for biotic conditions, abiotic conditions, abiotic environment. So what's in the places, what's the conditions, the abiotic conditions in the places, the environment, all the micro and macro climate and soil, etc. And the M is for movement, the movement of individuals. And they tried to model it. I mean, it's a very, and the overlap between those three big areas is where the species is present. The species is present where there is the environmental conditions for the species to live, and then they have food. They don't have competitors that have displaced them. They don't have diseases that have finished with their populations. They do have those facilitators for that, like those mycorrhizae, etc. And then the movement is the species have been able to arrive to a particular place. So when they try to make models, just purely theoretical models out of it, Jorge Soberón told me, no, we found several attractors. Attractors is a moment where the model creates multiple solutions and you cannot solve it. So you find attractors that you cannot solve. For sure, it's nature, it's complex. Okay. What we do is try to simplify and make models that are either general models that are too simple, or we lose generality and we make specific models with more parameters that are more adjusted to reality, to a particular system, but we lose generality. Okay? So a model can be either general or specific. It's, you cannot do both things at the same time.
So are you, when you're doing this modeling, are you, and this might not be a fair question, are you primarily working for how working with fairly healthy baselines, or is this more aimed toward what happens in crises, as in the current ecological crisis?
So, yeah, the thing is, well, I try not to make model. Well, I do it when I have to, okay, and when I'm somebody asks for help but I'm not a person that makes models for practical conservation planning, for example. I did it in the past, and I realized that, I mean, these are really powerful tools, but we are miles away from what politicians can take in this sense. So we've got very, very powerful tools, but policy is not made out just of these tools. We can use simpler tools for the level of resolution that we got from political decisions, because they take into account, I mean, I'm not saying that they are not interested in conservation, is that they have to take into account many other things, social development, etc. So in my opinion, we are we already have tools that are too powerful for the questions we are being made. Okay. And I do a lot of theoretical models for trying to understand the whys of the processes. What happens when you've got a symbiosis and some species it's helping another, and how does it promote the colonization of new habitats, for example? That's something we have just recently modeled. And for that, we use just a simple model of a pigeon and lice. and colonizing a new island with a new environment and how it affects, depending on whether depending on how much does the lice affect the pigeon, the probability of survival of both the species and the probability of adapting to the new conditions. So I do these kind of theoretical models, just to make things clear about that. So models are, there are many kinds of models and we can use them in many ways.
So discussions. Go ahead.
Going back to what you said about the baseline, the ideal is to have the baseline in something that we can, I mean, we cannot say the pristine conditions, because pristine conditions are very rare right now in nature, so as to measure it. But we try to approach as much as possible to the basic natural conditions, like the pre-industrial conditions, if you want. Try to approach them as a baseline. The thing is that when you make models to the things that are happening right now, I mean, you reach a lot of tipping points. And tipping points, you know how they work. It's just, I mean, the system changes completely. You've got a shift in the system. And it's very, very, very difficult to predict what's going to happen after one of these shifts. That's the thing.
So a question that, and this again may not be fair because it will probably be different by all different biotypes, but a question that I've really enjoyed discussing with quite a few people is that you have, for example, the redwood trees can live 2,000 years. Yeah. And Thomas Berry, many decades ago, said that he doesn't believe that an old growth forest, or whatever we want to call it, would be in a state of equilibrium, that it's always, he called it creative disequilibrium. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering about, you know, let's say you have a long term, by which I mean the region has been fairly ecologically stable, if I can say that word, for 2,000 years, you know, since the last ice age or something.
Yeah.
How much, again, I'm sorry if this is really unfair, but I just find it really fascinating. How much still, we've been focusing a little bit on how biodiversity changes over space in this conversation. Yeah. How about over time, if you have events like a flood comes through the forest, a blowdown, just standard, but you don't have industrial civilization hammering it.
Yeah.
How does biodiversity change over time in a fairly long term? Do you see what I'm trying to get at? Like if yeah. you have a place that's been a marsh that is undisturbed for 3,000 years, how mm-hmm. much dramatic change is probably happening? Dramatic ecological biodiversity change is probably happening in it.
Yeah, the thing is that we don't know when the changes are going to be enough to us to make a change, a shift in the state of the system. Okay, that's one of the things we know. And actually we started to know it since the 60s, actually. So I'm going to use an example from, I mean, the redwood is a really nice example, the redwood forest, because actually those forests started to grow. I read a bit about how they grow, and I haven't been into California, unfortunately. But they started to grow in very different conditions than now. Okay, but I'm going to use an example I've got more nearby, which is the, how you call the fagus trees. It's how is it the name? It's fagus sylvaticus. Anyway, it's one of these deciduous trees that we've got in the north of Europe, and they reach to the northern part of Spain, of the Iberian Peninsula. But we've got 500 kilometers to the south in the mountains nearby here. we got a couple of forests from the from those fagus. Okay, they are quite common in the north, and, but here they are rare. And they are rare because they are not in their climatic area. I mean, they are not recruiting or almost not recruiting new individuals. They have all the individuals. They have some recruit, but very little because they have in two small pockets within the mountains that remain colder than around. Okay. The thing is that as climate warms after, they are a true remnant from the ice age. Okay. From 10,000 years ago. Beech forests. Okay. So those beech forests remain there because of the conditions that, I mean, established there in former conditions. And they remain because they are able to maintain their own microclimate. Okay. But as climate warms, there will be a point where they just won't be able to do it anymore and they will collapse. The problem is predicting when they will collapse. Okay, and that depends on many factors. It depends on how much climate changes, but also how well they are able to maintain the microclimate, for example. And with a marsh, it may be a similar case. Okay, so,
No, go ahead, please.
Yeah. So a marsh can be maintained if it's able to maintain enough brackish water there for a long time. Okay, if the precipitation regime changes with climate change, it will receive less water. But if it's able to keep it, and if it's able to, something that marshes do is that reduce evaporation, it may stay for longer. I mean, and continue with a relatively unchanged, it's never unchanged, it always changes a bit, always changes a bit, with that, but with a relatively unchanged functioning, in progressively more longer droughts, until it reaches a moment where the drought is so long that it dries out. And what is happening in some marshes in Spain, in the interior, is that they actually burn out. There is a fire, and you've got a lot of organic matter there that burns. And that you are in a completely different state. Then you've got a tipping point, and then you lose the marsh. That's the thing.
So you talked about tipping points a few times, and I think, can we introduce that topic to people a bit more in that, at one point, people seem to have collectively thought that one unit of harm to a forest or one unit of pollution caused one unit of harm to the forest, to the river, or whatever. But that is no longer really considered the case. And it's that a community or system will attempt to maintain some sort of stasis until there'll be a dramatic change. I want to say one more thing and then I'll shut up on this and you can take it wherever you want. But I think about this in terms of bodies that I just broke my finger a couple of weeks ago and the finger is, I saw the x-ray and that it's growing new bone. And that's great. And if you get cut, you know, your arm will heal. But if you lose too much blood, then you no longer have that capacity for self-regeneration.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that that's pretty central to your modeling as well, right?
Yes. Yes. So the thing is that, I mean, you can model process as linear. So it's what you said, one unit of impact makes one unit of change, or one makes two, or whatever. But the thing is that those changes accumulate, okay? And they may reach a point where the system, the ecosystem, cannot go back. Okay? That's a tipping point. Tipping point is a moment when you've got a shift in the state of a system and it starts to be something else. And it starts to function in a different way. Okay? And that can be because of external conditions that are not that are affecting the system, or it can be because of internal conditions that are affecting it. So for I know we are not talking about many specific examples. We are talking about fairly theoretical things, but it can be applied to any ecosystem or any kind of system like the body. The example of the blood is what you say. We have a certain capacity. If you donate blood, they ask you for half a liter or something like that. I don't know how much is it in gallons, but anyway, it's half a liter. We've got about 6 liters, and in one day we can get again that half a liter. If you lose 2 liters, you're in a very, very difficult position. Okay. So as to regenerate, and it is likely that you die, for example, because you lose a lot of blood. In the case of ecosystems, you can have a reduction in productivity or a reduction in area. For example, imagine fragments in the forest. If you make fragments smaller, because you construct first a road, then houses, then backyards from the houses, then you put them all, or you've got another kind of development, or you are simply like it's happening in the Amazon. I mean, the families get there, they burn something to create the some to establish, then they burn to sell the wood, and then they put their cows, and they start doing that, and that it starts to create smaller and smaller and smaller forest fragments that are more separated to one each other, okay? So when those fragments get smaller, they can host less individuals of a species, okay? At the beginning, you may have, and actually there is and some new methods, some new analytical methods that John Chase, who was, I don't know where he was, he's from the US, but he's now in Germany working at the IDF, a synthesis center. He has identified when these smaller fragments, some new tools based on old ideas, to identify when those smaller fragments actually have just have less individuals, but they continue functioning more or less in the same way, because the proportions of individuals within the species, it's relatively the same. They remain ecologically similar, but they get to a point where the system collapses, and some species that are more able to live in open areas or near the new conditions, I mean, or I don't know which species are most efficient scavengers there, but for example, here the seagulls have colonized the interior of the Iberian Peninsula because they are quite effective scavengers, so they live out of trash. And storks as well. Storks, they had a decline, but now they have learned how to feed on dump sites, and they are part of the winners. So that has altered the former, you can say, equilibrium. It's always a dynamic equilibrium. And now you've got a completely different community than we have. Some species are winning a lot, and other species are rare or are getting extinct. Okay? Because the fragments are so smaller or have changed so much that they cannot hold the same functioning as they did before. Okay? And that's happening in many, many, many places. And that has happened throughout time. In many instances, as climate was changing through during the glaciations or before.
So a tipping point doesn't necessarily have to be we see it a lot, but it doesn't have to always be a negative thing. I'm thinking about I remember when I was a kid, maybe 5 years old, six or seven, probably, because I was reading. So I was reading in this little magazine about how there was an island, a volcanic island, Surtsey, had just came up. And this was, the article said, so children, it was a children's magazine. So children, here's an island that's younger than you. And then it was an ecological magazine. And so they wrote articles about it every year or two with what was happening to the ecology of the island. So that can be, I mean, you can have tipping points go that direction too, right? Where you have nothing and then you've got a few spiders and a few plants and then...
Yeah. So to use an example, that's part of the ecological succession, okay? And we know there are tipping points there as well. So, for example, in one of the systems I work with, which is shrubs in sand dunes here in the Iberian Peninsula, in the interior of the not near the beach, in sands in the interior, there are these two spiny species. Okay, they have a cohort of species living with them. Two spiny shrubby spiny species. Okay, that the first one is a colonizer, and it's able to live with very 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 little organic matter in the soil. And as this species grows, it's a cation species. It can host other species behind. And between those species that live, behind, beneath it, and its own spines and small leaves that fall down to the soil, it provides the soil with more organic matter. It accumulates organic matter up to a point where the other species can get in. So the other species gets in, displaces the first one, taking profit of the organic matter that the other species and the community associated to it has accumulated there in the sand dune. And they are colonizing to a most mature space. We can call it mature space. And if you continue, you can have even pine trees or juniperous trees colonizing those areas in particular parts of the sand dune. And what they do actually is they fix the dune. So something that was moving before, and it was a very harsh environment, now is consolidated sandy soil. Okay, and you get pine forests, etc. And it all starts with a few colonizers putting some organic matters and nitrogen and other nutrients into the soil and allowing to make some tipping points to the other side. And Sartre probably there was one or two really nice examples of how this happens.
So we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. And first, is there something you wanted to talk about that I haven't given you the opportunity having to do with this?
Yeah, the things that we have diverged a lot from what we initially thought, which is the role of species interactions in all of this that we've been talking about. We've been talking about this, but there is an important part. I already mentioned it, that some species facilitate others. They have positive interactions. You already mentioned that the need to have this particular mycorrhizae. Okay. So one of the things we are trying to model is which is the effect of different kinds of interactions on this process of colonizing or losing populations from one place and the other. Okay. We are trying to make it simple. I work in community ecology, and sometimes you work with communities with many, many different species from different individuals. But as you mentioned, that's complex and intractable. Okay. So we work with, diversity gradients, how many species are here and why they diminish throughout, towards the colder areas or towards the areas that have the environments are newer or towards the upper part of the mountains, etc. that's one way of working with the biodiversity. Other way is trying to understand what happens with the interactions between pairs of species between reduced subsets of species. Okay. So some of the things we are studying right now, it's what's the impact of those particular interactions in several systems. For example, you mentioned the redwoods, right? I mean, last week we were talking about how to design a work to see how holm oaks, evergreen holm oaks from the Iberian Peninsula, and cork oaks interact when they coexist, when they live together. Do they compete? Do they help each other? Do the mycorrhizae from one of them helps the other to grow? Okay. And the thing is that when you start to look at that, particularly with plants, but you can find some examples in animals, you find many competitive interactions for sure, but you've got many positive interactions where for two species it's better to be together than to be alone. Okay. And so, for example, we've been working now for 10 years we are doing experiments with mosses, with little moss pads. We create more moss pads. And together with people from the Autonomous University of Madrid, I've got several colleagues who are moss specialists. And we have created this experimental system where we put mosses to grow together in different conditions. I mean, in greenhouses, but also outside. And we measure how well they do when they grow separately or when they grow together. And we are measuring how they grow in 3 by 3 centimeter squares. Actually, it's a very tight, very small system. Okay. And what we have seen is that we see more positive interactions than we see negative interactions. And we could be expecting that the species will be competing for a space because it's a really close space. Okay. It's a really small space. They will have to compete. But actually, they, in many cases, it's not in all of the cases, but it's in more than half of the cases, or rather than more than half, we more often see positive interactions than negative. Okay. In this particular case, we believe it is that because, I mean, most pads are really, the mosses are something that they call, they are poikilohedric, which means that they don't have a vascular system to take the water to all places of their body. Okay. So they have to rely on making these moss pads or on the humidity of the soil. Okay. But if they make a moss pad, they are able to retain more water and take it to, and that's something that one species can do very well, but can help other species to thrive within the moss pad. Okay. So it helps them. That species is not excluded from the moss pad, for example. That's a particular case with mosses, but we see many other cases throughout nature. Okay. And that tells you that it's not only competition what drives this presence within that. Mycorrhizae are another excellent example. It's a symbiosis. It's a symbiosis that is helping colonize many, many areas to plant species.
Yeah, but it just seems so obvious to me how much of healthy communities are based on those, we can call them relationships or positive interactions or whatever you want to call them. Yeah. It's a forest that is dependent on salmon, the trees in it, and I'm not making this number up, the trees in it grow 3 times faster when there are salmon present than when they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And likewise, the trees provide shade for the salmon. They provide hormones that tell the fish to go to sleep in the winter. They fall over and provide habitat. It's just, it seems so clear to me that the community is based on a building up of all these relationships.
Yeah, but when you talk to students, the competition is so embedded into our way of thinking, and it wasn't already embedded in the way of in our evolutionary thinking since Darwin. So embedded there that the people that think about interactions like it's competitive interactions, always. The idea is that competition is the most important driving force of how nature is shaped. I mean, you know it's the law. We call it the forest law or the nature's law. Is that the stronger thrives and eliminates the others? Okay, but if you think about that, take mycorrhizae. It's a symbiosis, and it's responsible for I don't know the exact number, but it's the majority of nitrogen fixation in the world. And we all depend, our proteins are made of nitrogen. So, and it's because of a symbiosis. So there are many, many, many positive interactions. This is not to say that there is no competitive interactions. Of course, there is no predation or that there is no pathogens having negative effects on species populations. But positive interactions are really widespread.
Even the so-called negative ones, there's this one parasite who goes from a clam to from a mussel, which it doesn't do anything to a fish, and then the next host is a seabird, and it goes up and flashes its belly. The parasite makes the fish do weird things, including flashing their belly to surface, and the seabirds then catch them because they can see that.
Yeah.
And what they've found is that if you remove that parasite from the estuary community, the seabirds starve because it's too hard to catch the fish. So even though, yes, it's bad luck for that particular fish, and I sure wouldn't want to get one, that the parasite is actually, the pathogen is actually benefiting, is driving the entire community.
Yeah, it's building up diversity, actually. Yeah.
So that whole... I mean, maybe that's what we should focus on. Maybe we should do another one where we just focus on the role of cooperation, or not cooperation, but whatever word, symbiosis, whatever word you want to use. Because here's the thing, and this, it frustrates me so much when people talk about, when they talk about the law of nature being exploiting the best or exploiting the most.
Yeah.
The thing is, if you harm your land base, If you, by you living and dying, your land base is harmed, that means that your way of life will in the long term not be sustainable.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, there are many, many examples, even classical examples like the elephants and the acacia trees, and how a large population of elephants ends up with all the acacia trees. And they, that's the thing. We are so focused on competition within similar species, between similar species, that we don't realize that there are many, many interactions that are positive, even between species. And also, what you say, some of those arguably negative species or the pathogens, for example, are a good control. But what Bob Riclebs, just came up with the idea like 15 years ago or something like that. Bob Riclebs was a great biogeographer, and actually he was talking about disintegrating the ecological community and thinking about regional communities, because many of the processes we are talking about are happening at the regional level, at large regions. And what one thing he was saying is that pathogens create a lot of heterogeneity within those regions. And I mean, they affect a lot of some populations, but others don't. And they create some isolation between populations. They foster evolution. And they are creating biodiversity. They are creating new interactions. Some populations are going to suffer or disappear, but creating some isolation. But one of the main drivers of biodiversity may be also the existence of pathogens that have this patchy way of affecting species.
It's too bad that this interview is about over, because I think we're getting to some really fun stuff now. And it's been a great interview, but can you, two things, can you let people know about your website and your work, how they can find out more about it? And also, can you give some startling or fun example of species interactions that one might not think? Like it's kind of cool that if you bring wolves back into Yellowstone, the wolves chase the herbivores away from the stream side, and also beavers come in and help make better trout habitat. So the point is, the introduction of wolves makes better trout habitat, and it's just, you wouldn't think that off the top of your head.
Well, I'm about my website is jhortal.com, and it's I try to include all my research there, and we have to, I mean, I'm not a great communicator, but we have we try to put a lot of information there about the papers we are making, etc., and the people who work with me. So please feel free to go there and reach and see the things we have been doing in different aspects. But so, and through that, you may be able to find people who is making a much better work than I'm doing, because it's a communal effort, and we are working in big networks. Okay, and about examples, is that there are so many nice examples of that happening. For example, there was this park in the Netherlands where they created a national park because they had a lot of native species there. Some of them were, I think some of them were endemic plant species, but they had sheep there just eating, grazing there. Okay. So when they made the national park, they took the sheep away, and the community started to homogenize, because the disturbance made by the sheep grazing started to allowed some species to thrive too much and to displace others that were linked to the low level disturbance that is the grazing of the sheep. Okay, that happens in many, many occasions. I'm trying to think something more closer to here, but I can't think of anyone right now. I'm thinking a lot of negative effects of, for example, the effect of Portuguese sailors. We've been talking before the interview briefly about the Azores. And when the Portuguese sailors were arriving to the islands, they used to take with them some pigs and some rabbits just to release them. And there were also some cats that were escaping, and rats. And those, they were not only Portuguese sailors, many others, but I mean, they used to release goats, pigs, and rabbits that they were able to live on the islands, but they also extinguished a lot of species. When the sailors arrived back, they had populations of pigs and rabbits or goats, the ones that had survived, plus the cats that have escaped from the, and the rats that have escaped from the ships, but under the sake of extinguishing a lot of species that we will never get to know, okay? But yeah, I'm trying to think of a kind of these positive interactions, but right now I don't have the right example. Perhaps because I work with insects, so that's my original background is with insects. But yeah, it's we always get to know the problems that happen when they. But well, one interesting one, going back to my damn beetles, I don't know if we when we made another interview. Some months ago, I may have brought this back, but when they introduced cows, big herbivores, to Australia, the cows do eat a lot of grass and they poo. And there were no species there adapted to process that dung. So they were literally covering the grasslands with dung. So they have had to import dung beetles to be able to recycle all that dung, for example.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Joaquin Hortal. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.